Perhaps I could call the meeting to order. I just have something very short to say here. One of the great pleasures of having gotten to be director of the Southeast Asia Center here at LSE is that I got to engage more with the Southeast Asian students. And many people might not know, we know that LSE in general is a very international society, is a very international group of people. And of course, we know about the very large numbers of students that come to us, LSE, from the United States, where LSE has long been viewed as Let's See Europe. Many students come to us from China, the world's most populous country. LSE, through the British Empire, has long held ties with India and other parts of the Commonwealth. While we are international, it's also the case that LSE enrolls more undergraduates from Southeast Asia than from China, India, and the United States, the world's three most populous countries. And let me repeat, that's China, India, and the United States combined. So LSE has an excellent, extensive representation in people generally, students generally, who are interested in Southeast Asia issues. Of course, we have long had representation and student societies from individual Southeast Asian countries, but the point of getting together all of the different diverse groups into an ASEAN or Southeast Asian organized society was that we could then, as a society, look at, consider, and treat issues that are either common to all of Southeast Asia or take on challenges that can only be usefully dealt with by looking at things in a regionally integrated way. With great pleasure, I was, over this last year, able to come in touch with students at LSE who wanted to start an ASEAN society. And we have worked together, the ASEAN Society and the Southeast Asia Center, extensively over the last year. And I'm pleased to launch on this occasion yet another of these joint events. So I'm now going to step down after introducing Key and Gillian from the ASEAN Society, who will come up and give a short presentation to you before we have our panel presentation.
Thank you, Professor Kwa. Good afternoon, His Excellencies, and all distinguished guests and friends attending this year's inaugural LSE Southeast Asia Forum. Firstly, I'd like to congratulate the LSE Southeast Asia Center for organizing this very successful conference today. It is my honor to be speaking in front of this distinguished audience to share more about the LSESU ASEAN Society. Let me begin with a little bit more about the society. Set up in 2015, the LSE Students' Union ASEAN Society was set up with three main aims. Firstly, to connect Southeast Asian students within their large network here, as elaborated upon by Professor Kwa. Secondly, to facilitate the exchange of ideas in a very, very good academic and learning environment here in LSE. And lastly, to promote the ASEAN and Southeast Asian culture within the school. So let me elaborate more on my first point. LSE has a huge international community. From official statistics, close to 10% of LSE students are domiciled in Southeast Asia. Most of them, indeed, are members of their national societies, such as the Singapore Society, the Malaysian Society, the Thai Society, which are our three biggest national societies from within the Southeast Asian region. Therefore, there is great potential for the ASEAN Society to be a platform to connect and bridge all these students together to interact beyond just students from their home societies. More about my second point. We hope to be here to facilitate an exchange of ideas and foster an environment that is conducive to this through academic discussions and student conferences and competitions, which I will be elaborating more upon later. I would further venture that LSE facilitates a great environment for academic debate. we frequently host distinguished speakers, ranging from academic experts to key political figures to leading business people. Just a few weeks ago, the LSE Southeast Asia Centre hosted the ex-Prime Minister of Thailand, Abhisit Vejjachirva, in a discussion regarding ASEAN and our new role in the new global order. The LSE SIAC and ASEAN Society also hosted the previous Philippine ambassador to the UK, His Excellency Enric Manalo, earlier in March this year, with a talk on Philippine foreign policy, the arbitration process, and its stance on the maritime disputes in Southeast Asia. There are therefore many opportunities for Southeast Asian students to engage with key figures in this excellent environment for academic discussion. And how do we promote the Southeast Asian culture throughout society? So firstly, we hope to target ASEAN students from within Southeast Asian countries who are away from their home countries. We also hope to target non-Southeast Asian LSE students, and not forgetting students from other schools within the UK, for instance, from Warwick University, such as their upcoming Warwick ASEAN conference, which strives to achieve the same goals as we do. In summary, we hope to connect students, facilitate discussions, and promote the Southeast Asian culture. Within 10 weeks since our inception, we have held 11 events, ranging from formal academic-related panel discussions, such as a panel about the Philippines elections and reform agenda, with speakers such as current attorneys, lawyers, and entrepreneurs from the Philippines. We've also had a talk about political activism in Singapore, with speakers from the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore, and also other distinguished guests from Singapore. Next, we have also had several speaker events, such as the one hosting the ex-ambassador of Philippines to the UK about the South China Sea issue, which I mentioned earlier. We've also held several student-led events. For instance, a model ASEAN conference held in the style of the model United Nations conferences, which are role-playing simulations of behind-the-scenes political activity, with students taking on roles of political figures in various countries to engage deeper into critical issues. For this year's model ASEAN, the topic was about the international refugee crisis and about Southeast Asia's interactions with this issue. And also, we have held what we christened as serial series, which are informal discussions regarding topics such as democracy, held in the morning, which we feel is a novel way of engaging busy LSE students. And I'm proud to announce that because of all our efforts and also the support of the student community, we have been awarded the Best New Society by the LSE Students Union, something which we are very proud of, and which the current committee would like to thank the ex-committee for contributing a lot of their time and effort for. So what are some of our future plans? Firstly, we hope to involve and engage an even greater number of students. Right now, we are in the midst of establishing connections with various national societies in LSE, such as the Singapore, Malaysia, Thai societies, the Vietnamese societies, and the upcoming Indonesian society. Also, we hope to forge connections beyond just the Southeast Asian societies. We are in talks with the UN United Nations Society and the China Development Society, amongst others. And beyond LSE, with other universities, such as what I mentioned earlier with Warwick University, and to also branch out into more novel areas, such as talks on economic trends and developments in green technology. We also hope to have further collaborations with the LSE SIAC, which will be further elaborated on by Keong in the next part of this presentation. And one of it, which is this infographic contest, which we have had for the past month, which produced these three young winners from LSE itself. So connect with us if you want to find out more. Our Facebook page has 450 likes at the moment, and our WordPress has been up for the past few months with featuring our past and future events, as well as academic publications, such as the interview series done by Keong, our academic director. Thank you for your time, and I will now be handing my time over to the academic director, Keong, who will be telling you more about the ASEAN Society's infographic contest. Thank you.
Thanks, Jillian. So why do we have the infographic competition? So Professor Danny Quart just gave the theme of Horizon, and we felt it was very appropriate, given that Horizon triggers the idea of like a vast, endless plane, one that is fraught with unknown as it is with opportunities. So how do we try and make sense of the horizon and what it holds for the future? So how are we going to walk down the path towards that plane, and how can we best harness the ideas and inputs that our generation possesses? This is what is in line with the spirit of the society, and from which very outset had to be involve as many students in LSE with the concept and idea, and more importantly, institution of ASEAN. Also, it also ties in very well with the academic-centric focus of the society. So why this competition? To think beyond national and frame the issues within the larger context of ASEAN, where there are as many opportunities as there are challenges. A recent interview on the ASEAN Economic Community cited the growth potential of the region, and on the other hand, one cannot ignore a certain degree of impotency of ASEAN where the handling of the South China Sea issue is concerned. All these issues require attention, but this is not about the nitty-gritty, but rather harnessing the future and linking academia with the potential for change. We have to identify what these challenges and potentials are, and therefore we have these three speakers today, and a means to which they can be addressed, as will their presentation will tell us more about, and also to bridge the gap between practice and academia to imagine possibilities for our future. So our future plans is to involve and engage even greater number of students, like branch out and further collaborations, as what Jillian has said earlier. So a bit more about the competition. The competition was judged by three fellows from the LSE CR, namely Dr. Nick Long, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the London School of Economics and Political Science. He's a specialist in anthropology of Indonesia and the Malay world, with a particular focus on the ways that processes of political change influence the experience of self, agency, and relations with others. Secondly, will be Dr. Hyung Ban Shin, Associate Professor of Geography and Urban Studies at the LSE as well. His research includes the critical analysis on the political economic dynamics of urban development, as well as Dr. Felicia Yap, who we have the privilege of having with us today, and who will be greatly involved in the Q&A session afterwards. Dr. Felicia Yap is an associate of the LSE Sui Hock Southeast Asia Centre, and Dr. Yap's research centres on the Japanese occupation of Southeast and East Asia during the Second World War. The focus of her work is primarily on the wartime experiences of the Japanese-held prisoners of war and civilians in occupied Malaya, Singapore, Borneo, and Hong Kong. So how was the competition judged? Firstly, will be the significance of the issue communicated and centrality of the to the concerns of ASEAN citizens overall, and that was judged at a 10-point criteria. And the second issue will be that of design, which is, once again, out of 10 points, and the power and clarity of the message communicated, and how appealing the infographic was. So now, without further ado, I'll get the first speaker to join us. She's Paul, and she's a second-year student taking economics and geography. Yep. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon, His Excellencies and distinguished guests. I feel very honoured to be able to present my infographic. It's quite straightforward, so I'll just plunge into it straight away. So the confluence of an emerging middle class and a youthful population really lands ASEAN in a very, very advantageous position. And the potential for harnessing technology is unbounded. And I identify five salient technological trends that I think are rather important, but just to give proper due credit, the first four trends were ideas that I took from a McKinsey report, but obviously I will elaborate them in my own words and from my perspective as a youth. And the last point was something that I thought was very important. So the first point is on mobile internet. Well, I deem mobile internet a very powerful tool that can dissolve geographical barriers and grant rural populations access to information, products, and services. Well, being plugged online really expedites business processes and transactions. It really helps the flow of exchange of ideas, and it really culminates in a system, an ecosystem where everyone is connected all the time. And just last summer, I did an internship in Jakarta, and when I was in the car, I was never not caught in a jam. I was always caught on the jam. And there was once when getting from point A to B, although in Google Maps it told me it would only take me 15 minutes, I actually took 1 hour and 50 minutes. And one thing I realized when I was in the car was that everybody was on their phones. The car passengers in front of me, beside me and behind me, and even the ones in my own car, they were all constantly plugged online and looking at their devices. And these devices in our hands, they are breathtakingly powerful, these smartphones and tablets that we all carry around. And in Jakarta and Bangkok and all these other big cities, traffic is a big challenge. And capitalising on technology to digitalize anything that requires travelling, I think it's a huge opportunity for us all. And it's no surprise that e-commerce and delivery apps are such booming sectors in ASEAN today. Now, I was just thinking, if I'm living in a really rural part of Indonesia and I really need to get a product that's located in mainland Jakarta, but I really can't stand the thought of bearing with maybe a five-hour jam just to get all the way there, then ordering something online is something that really would appeal to me, and therefore I feel that mobile internet is a really great potential for ASEAN. Now, secondly, with a combined population of 650 million people, the potential for harnessing big data also cannot be ignored. Now, the rising middle-class population, as we all know, presents vast consumption opportunities that all retailers must reach out and tap on. Japan and the UK are fast-aging populations, and China, as we know, lifted its one-child policy just last year amidst concerns on its growing population. And on the other hand, you have a country like Indonesia where nearly half of its population is below 30 years old. So we got to tap on these young, tech-savvy, vibrant middle-class people and effectively harness big data so that we can achieve cross-channel success in sales and marketing. And the potential for big data transcends merely understanding and targeting customers just for sales and marketing purposes. It can be used to optimize business processes, improve public healthcare system, and enhance law and security, and even augment sports performance. The opportunities are limitless. And today, companies do more sales in a month than we used to do decades ago. So they definitely need strong and sound ways to store data and retrieve information. Well, that being said, I have to caution that database security is another big issue. I don't really have an answer to that, but hopefully we can all circumvent this problem. Now, thirdly, automation can, rather unambiguously, lead us down a path of efficiency and rapid development. With advances in artificial intelligence, machine learning, and natural user interfaces, machines have very quickly outstripped the need for humans to complete mundane tasks, and robots are so inexpensive nowadays. However, I do certainly need to caution that while this equips our workers to be more productive, perform bigger, better tasks faster, this sounds very utopian, and I mean, it's going to affect income inequality, and it presents a very looming threat over unskilled workers. So I will elaborate on this issue of inequality and development in my concluding remarks later. So my fourth point is about cloud technology. So I feel that it's another important trend that has the propensity to reduce costs by pooling and consolidating information. And this is widely practiced in the healthcare industry, where hospitals pool patient data, and this allows for more effective patient treatment. Unfortunately, cloud adaptation is quite fragmented across ASEAN. We have countries like Singapore and Malaysia who have comparatively higher rates of adaptation of cloud technology as compared to the Philippines, Indonesia, Thailand, and Vietnam, but definitely there is room to grow. Now, last but not least, I believe that social media will be wielded as a powerful tool now and in generations to come. Social media is something that I identify very strongly with because it came about at a time where I was very very keen to explore the internet, and I think it's something that most people in their 20s would identify with as well. And platforms like Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, and so on, these apps help people like me and all the other users stay connected with each other. And it's amazing. I can just Facebook message my primary school friend even without her handphone number, even without her email address. And all these wouldn't be able or wouldn't have been possible many decades ago. So all these networks also present vast advertising and sales opportunities, and it's to the point where such social sales comprise up to 30% of the volume of all transactions, according to a report by Bain. And a common scenario is where a consumer is interested in buying a product and connects with a seller via Facebook and perhaps agrees to make a purchase and arranges for payment and delivery on a peer-to-peer basis. And this is very, very common. And in doing this research for my presentation, again, I was reading a report by Bain where they interviewed this particular Thai consumer who said that she bought her tea on social media and she liked it because it was a small batch production. She thought it was very niche and she enjoyed interacting with the seller. And if she had seen this product, like in a brick-and-mortar store, she probably wouldn't have bought it, which is a rather interesting trend, I must say. So definitely, social media is not one to be underestimated. There's plenty of room to grow. But the enthusiasm for recognizing all these phenomena of like technology must never be just taken at face value. Definitely, I think that they have to be acted upon and materialized into making an ASEAN that is one that's technologically advanced and developed. But then again, technology will definitely affect development. As a geography and economics student, I study a little bit about international economics, and there's one very interesting concept that we learn that's called skill-biased technological change. So that just means that there's a shift in the production technology that favours the skilled workers, favours the educated, the more able people. And when you have skill-biased technological change, when there's an increase in demand for your products, there's an increase in demand for all these skilled labour, and which also means that there's a decrease in demand for unskilled labour. So what's going to happen to all these unskilled labour who are now getting made redundant and they feel that they can no longer compete in the new global marketplace? Well, that's a question that I don't have the answer to. I wish I had, but I mean, there's definitely room for potential for technology to equip all these unskilled workers to be more productive than they are today. So thank you very much.
Hello, everyone. I'm Felicia Yap. I was one of the judges of this infographics competition. It was a huge privilege to be on a judging panel because the judges were hugely impressed by the quality of the entries which were submitted. And Paul really stood out for us because it was a hugely well-written, assertive blurb which we received from Paul. We thought that the message was simple yet powerful. And I personally thought that Paul made a very good observation about the increasing importance of social media networks within the ASEAN context. And really, what stood out for the rest of the panelists on the judging side of things was the clarity and the effectiveness of the message, and also the way to look at the potential of technology for how it could be developed and harnessed further in the region. And we felt that maybe Paul could have addressed the issue of inclusivity a bit more, but overall the reasoning was superb, the argument was strong, and we thought it was a hugely great effort. So well done, Paul. So next up, we have Ying Zhao. Moving away from technology to the issue of security, so looking specifically at 8 ASEAN horizons in this particular area of security. Now, Ying Zhao is currently a student of comparative politics. She's doing an MSc in comparative politics at the government department of the LSE. And she's originally from Nanjing in China. And she is interested in Chinese politics. So we look forward to your presentation. Yeah.
Good afternoon, everyone. I feel very honored and very lucky to win the competition and speak here. So my topic today is about the growing the security problems in the Southeast Asian region. The Southeast Asian region attains growing attention and importance in the world, and its security issues become a concern shared by the globe. In my infographic, I generally divide the security issues into three parts: territorial disputes, domestic political stability, and regional economic stability. But in the infographic, is you can see from six general parts telling different things, but I integrate it into three parts within my speech. So I believe that most of them are well covered by experts' lectures in the morning, and I hope that my presentation could give a simplified, perhaps not that comprehensive, synthesis of those issues. So the maritime territorial disputes are most intense in the South China Sea, between China and other competing actors, such as the Philippines, Vietnam, Taiwan, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Brunei, due to abundant resources involved here. It is estimated that there are 11 billion barrels of oil and 190 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Although the Philippines appealed to the Permanent Court of Arbitration in Hague in 2014, and later Vietnam issued a statement to complement that appeal, the Chinese Foreign Ministry claimed that the Permanent Court of Arbitration did not have jurisdiction over the South China Sea issue and refused to engage in United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. I think that this territorial claim was rather criticized by Mr. Bill Hayton in the morning, but I think this diplomatic response of territorial claim was rather constrained by China's domestic nationalist and patriotic ideology. But we should be positive and patient in the forthcoming cooperation within the region in the future. With the prospect of new Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte being elected in 2016, the tension between China and the Philippines seemed to ease a little bit on the South China Sea compared to his predecessor Aquino III's tough insistence on multilateral settlements of South China Sea issue. Rodrigo Duterte is more open to bilateral cooperation and direct dialogue with China, and in turn asks for China's investment in infrastructure projects within the Philippines. Also, U.S. decided to send more troops and military equipments to the Philippines on a regular basis to avoid so-called escalation of of disputes and to mediate the unbalance of power. So there are many interests involved here, and according to the professor in the morning said there are still no it's still disputable about which framework to is better to for the regional peace and cooperation, but we need to remain positive on the issue. Apart from this, the tension between China and Japan over Diaoyu Island aroused nationalist sentiments within both countries and influenced the trade and investment, as we could remember the violent attack on Japanese business in mainland China in 2012 after a Japanese businessman purchased three islands in the Diaoyu chain. So after the 9/11, the U.S. launched a global war against terror and increased military presence in the Southeast region since then. And transnational militant Islamist group like Jemaah Islamiyah had cells in Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Although there is evidence of links between GI to Al-Qaeda and other, and the rise of more conservative Wahhabist version of Islam in Indonesia and Malaysia, even in Xinjiang province of China. terrorism and radical Islamism are not as disastrous as that in the Middle East. Political instability also came from the democratic process in Thailand and Myanmar. After a military coup in Thailand in 2014, Prayuth, the head of the National Council for Peace and Order, became the new prime minister. The promised election in 2015 was postponed to 2017. The forthcoming referendum on the new constitutional draft would be in the forthcoming 8th, 7th in this year. And the one controversial point in the new draft is regarding election rules of prime minister. If the draft would be passed, there will be the weak parties would be empowered within the Congress, and there will be a prospect of unstable coalition government in the future. As Aung San Suu Kyi was released and her party, National League for Democracy, won the Myanmar election in 2016, their relationship with the military still remains uncertain. And besides, the domestic politics also influenced the neighboring countries as well. As we can see, large amount of migrants, the refugees, flowed out of their homelands and seek home outside their countries. So in May 2015, thousands of Rohingya refugees from the Rakhine state of Myanmar and economic refugees from Bangladesh were stranded in the coast of Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia. The foreign ministries of the three countries held a meeting in Malaysia shortly afterwards and issued a joint statement on interim measures for the refugee crisis and demanded the international community to take the responsibility. However, the Australian Prime Minister refused with no, which is rather disappointed. And there is currently no mutual multilateral framework in settling the issue, as Professor Tian has mentioned in the morning. And there, in terms of the regional economic stability, Thailand faces great challenge to revive its economy after the military coup in the 2014, with the GDP to be 0.7 from the start of 2014. But there seems to be traces of revival currently, with the prospect of the GDP growth rate to be 3.7% in 2070. So probably we should be more positive about the economic growth there. In addition, the slowdown of economic growth of China due to industry upgrading has influenced other countries' economy because of its huge market. The domestic unstable stock market and the lower exchange rate accelerates capital outflow and aroused pessimistic view towards the market. So that would be a future danger of economic concern within the region. So besides the issues mentioned above, there are other security problems not covered by my speech or my infographic, such as the piracy and the environmental degradation. All those issues I have mentioned above demand close discussion and international consensus on solutions. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Xin Zhao. Well, I think if anyone wants to convey information well, they should use a map. And I think Xin Zhao did that really, really well. Clever use of this map of the region in the infographic. In terms of conveying information in a visually arresting way, it certainly did really well here. I felt that it presented a very good summary of some of the key problems and challenges which are faced within the ASEAN region. And the other judges thought that the blurb demonstrated a very comprehensive understanding of some of the key security issues which afflict the region. And we were also taken by the descriptive nature of both the infographic and the blurb. And definitely lots of material presented in a clear fashion. I know there was one judge who think that you could perhaps be a little bit bolder in setting up your views, particularly in terms of the present and future impact of these issues on the region. So maybe you can dwell on that a bit more in a Q&A afterwards. But thank you very much. Well done. So next up, moving away from security to inclusive growth and development, we have Cheryl Tom, who's a first-year student at the LSE, studying for a BSc in international relations. And she's originally from Singapore. And she hopes to specialise in international political economy in her third year. So without further ado, Cheryl.
Good afternoon, everyone. I hope we have had a great lunch. Thank you. I feel very honoured to be presenting today because I primarily submitted my application for this infographic contest on the last day, luckily for me, of the deadline, when I really wanted to come to this conference, but I was deterred by the admission fee. So here goes. So I hail from Singapore, and I would like to commence with a quote by Lee Kuan Yew, the founding father, who mentioned that while ASEAN's declared objectives were economic, social, and cultural, all knew that progress in economic cooperation would be slow. We were banded together more for political objectives, stability, and security. And it is with this in mind that I wish to dwell more on the secondary priority, economic growth and development in ASEAN. And before I really commence, two admissions. First, I feel very intimidated speaking on this topic, which is precisely the topic of the inaugural public event of the LSE Southeast Asian event, given by Dato Sri Nazi on the AAC, which Professor Danny Kwan might remember. And secondly, by the sheer expertise in this room, I'm sure many or even most of you must have studied, re-examined, and re-looked at ASEAN for more years than I've been born. But, all right. With my speech, three aspects. Firstly, on the infographic. Secondly, on a personal sharing. And thirdly, on optimism for the future of ASEAN based on some historical lessons. So firstly, on the infographic. I have given some statistics, some figures, which may seem glossy from the onset, where we see American FDI into ASEAN with a whopping $136 billion. And that is 11% of the global FDI inflow. To top that, tourist arrivals in the ASEAN region doubled from 2007 to 2014. However, perennial challenges remain, such as unequal, unsustainable economic growth, with the classic comparison between Myanmar and Singapore. Inequality and poverty lurks in the backdrop. And yet, I find the infographic remains a limited platform. It's limited by its nature, because it remains, based on the judges' comments, as I'm sure will be elaborated later, it remains just a detached compilation of facts and figures. And it is with this intent that I wish to complement this ostensible yet understandable disconnect with a more personal perspective from an ASEAN youth like myself. But one important qualifier, please. According to the McKinsey Insight report, more than 65% of the ASEAN population is under 35. And as mentioned previously by the first speaker, Pearl, given ASEAN's 635 million population, that is 400 million youths. So today I speak for myself or at most for Singaporean youths. Nonetheless, ASEAN to me has always remained more than a static theoretical concept from the history A-level syllabus or the newspapers.
my childhood has been peppered with ASEAN associations, many admittedly unbeknownst to me then. As an avid chess player growing up, I used to represent Singapore at various ASEAN competitions. I distinctly remember cultural performances after each weary day of competition. Looking back, these cultural exchanges were never mere casual entertainment for a laugh or a stretch. Indeed, they fitted into one of ASEAN's primary goals, which is agreed upon by the five founding states to accelerate cultural development in the region. My family has also been blessed with our domestic help, who hails from the Philippines, who I affectionately call Auntie Sylvia. And it is no coincidence that it's her birthday today. So happy birthday, Auntie. She represents many Filipinas who left their families and loved ones, most notably their infant children, for a foreign land, for example, Singapore, to earn their keep. However, the growing Filipino community in Singapore and the region still leaves much room for improvement in terms of social integration. Recent distasteful remarks about the congregation of Filipinas, that is, Filipino women, in front of Lucky Plaza, an iconic shopping centre on the shopping belt of Singapore, only echo sentiments of the NIMBY syndrome, the not in my backyard syndrome. And this was further reflected in the incident quite recently as well, when Singaporeans were up in arms protesting against the construction of a foreign workers' dormitory in the heart of a residential estate, the Serangoon Gardens residential estate in Singapore. In light of the growing proportion of migrant workers, which will be expected to hail from the region, ASEAN, I find grandiose notions of ASEAN's core mission, founding statement, one vision, one identity, one community, and even espoused in the so-called ASEAN anthem, which I'm sure is not that, how should I put it? We don't really hear about it much. Must be matched with grassroots efforts of comparable vigour to foster a greater sense of ASEAN identity amongst the population, young and old alike. Since moving to London recently, I've had the privilege to enjoy the conveniences of the EU, most prominently the ease of travel within the Schengen zone. While both regional blocs have witnessed recent successes, such as the growth in member states, each faces mounting challenges looming ahead. The upcoming historical referendum, Brexit, threatens to forever change the EU narrative. ASEAN faces the consistent power balance issue between China and India due to its geographic location in the centre of Asia. To this end, I find both blocs should look to each other for counsel and inspiration to chart the future. On top of that, I wish to inject some optimism into the regional bloc ASEAN based on some historical lessons, given the rather gloomy morning that we have had, condemning ASEAN as a talk shop and etc. So, from history, I find that the very unique ASEAN way, this preference for informality, the emphasis on confidence building, mutual consensus, as opposed to functional military pacts such as the ones prevalent in NATO, is a unique institution of ASEAN that should be cherished and will see us through the future. This approach was officialized by the 1976 TAC, the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, which emphasized on values such as sovereignty, the non-use of force, and non-intervention. And one classic case was in the clash of the South China Sea, which dated back way in 1990, when China refused to internationalize this issue, but agreed to the ways of the ASEAN ways to non-official platforms, such as a workshop on a workshop called Workshops on Managing Potential Conflict in the South China Sea, organized in Bali in 1990. Secondly, I think optimism for the future of ASEAN can be found. Can be found in the early successes of ASEAN as an institution to promote regional cooperation, something which is dearly needed today. The ASEAN Way, previously mentioned, espoused this new vision where war is no longer an acceptable instrument of conflict resolution. And ASEAN carved out a diplomatic role in the management of the Cambodian problem, also known as the Kampuchean conflict from 1979 to 91, which was triggered when Vietnam invaded Cambodia. ASEAN witnessed solidarity and collective diplomacy. For example, Singapore and Thailand alerted the international community, exerting pressure on then already established international bodies such as the UN to maintain recognition of Democratic Kampuchea, later then known as the CGDK, the Coalition Government of Democratic Kampuchea, rather than giving in to pressures to recognize the PRK, the Vietnam Installed People's Republic of Kampuchea. The later incorporation of Vietnam, the aggressor in that conflict, into ASEAN in 1995 is further testimony to this inclusive approach, which is now often dubbed as the sports shirt diplomacy, as we witness over the golf courses in Southeast Asia, where they usually have their casual conversations. To end off, I find that optimism for ASEAN is crucial, and it can be embodied on the chessboard, where I see four valuable assets, characteristics which diplomats of the ASEAN countries should aspire to continue displaying during their negotiations. Firstly, stability, embodied by the king with its measured moves. Stability is a value that all countries in ASEAN, at least, aspire to continue having, to continue cherishing for stability and predictability, at least in the external political environment. Secondly, openness, embodied by the lover, the queen. I find openness is something which the Western world can probably learn much from, because it's often quick to criticize the ASEAN way and other unique ASEAN institutions such as the weird handshake, for example. Thirdly, flexibility, represented by the knight in its rather queer movement. And flexibility is key for the fourth and final value of resolution, embodied by the humble pawn, the warrior, where this sheer perseverance and flexibility in negotiations to make compromises while at the same time preserving the ASEAN values is key for the future of ASEAN. And with that, I hope we keep in mind the optimism of ASEAN in spite of its current state and the perennial challenges that ASEAN is plagued by. Thank you.
Well done, Cheryl. That's an excellent presentation. I think that some of the more effective messages usually have a personal dimension, and I think Cheryl did that really well. We're bringing in a very personal outlook to the presentation and the infographic. One of the judges thought that the submission, I quote, takes a refreshingly thoughtful and critical approach to current affairs in ASEAN, presenting a good overview of achievements and challenges. I totally agree with that. And I think this whole reference to Singaporean perceptions of domestic workers definitely evokes some of the key some dimensions within the region, and also evokes the strong emotions that some of these contemporary developments in the region actually trigger among the citizens of ASEAN. So that's great.